Hello.
How are you?
How you doing, John?
Good.
Did you get the little note I sent you?
No, not yet.
Didn't you get the stuff on the book being sold?
Oh, yes, I did. I'm sorry. I did get that.
And
I apologize.
And the Mitchell interviews? And
yes, I did. I did see that. A little clipping, yes.
You're the one from Newsday.
Right.
Yeah, the book was sold in October.
Good. So you got the money in your pocket.
Well, that's what I hear. You know what that's all about. I have never seen a contract, like a book contract.
Is that a piece of work?
But well, every change I made, they bought. They wanted the book bad. St. Martin's and Macmillan ended up in the auction being the last two to go at each other.
Good.
And when it was all over, St. Martin's won, and they wanted it very badly. So I guess when we asked for things that weren't outrageous, yeah, I think so.
As you know, I've been out promoting your book for you. Did you get that word back from Barbara, what's her name?
Hauer?
Yeah, Hauer.
Yeah, I heard, once Mitchell died, which came as a, well, I talked to Mitchell an hour before he died.
I was sad to hear that. I really kind of sad. He's awfully, fairly young. I mean, he's just not that old a man.
Apparently, he wasn't taking care of his heart. And he had had a heart attack in Europe and hadn't told even his companion, Mary Dean. In fact, I had a long talk with Marty Mitchell, his daughter, just a couple of weeks ago. And she knew he was not as well as he looked. I was up there on the way to New York to see the publishers when I met with him and had lunch with him on October 7th. And I talked to him on the day he died. We were kidding about the election. I had just said, we'd been kidding about each other about who was going to win and by how much. And I told him it would be Bush 53-47. When I talked to him that day, he said, "You missed by a point." And I said, "I know." And then he came back and he said to me something like, "Hey, Len, how'd you do on the Electoral College?" And I said, "You sound like a campaign manager again." And he and Nixon had had a fight over this book 2 weeks earlier.
In fact, we did...
Did he
try to get Nixon to help you a little bit?
Yeah, not only... Well, it wasn't just that. He wanted Nixon to actively participate in the evidence phase of the book. And apparently they went to war over it. And in the end, he breaks with Nixon. And that's going to be one of the news in the book. I haven't said a lot about it. Dan Shore called me and asked me what's on the interviews. There's 90 hours that he and I talked. And he breaks with Nixon. And that came as...
That doesn't totally surprise me. I think everybody has, excepting Bibi.
Well, there's still a few... hanging in there. And he was very, very... Particularly on I think Watergate, but also on Moore Radford. He thought he was set up on Moore Radford, and he said it. He just it took him about 2 years to get to the point where he could say an unkind word about the man.
Well, I got the weirdest response and reaction from Barbara Hauer about your book, or one of the staff people there. I'm not sure which it was now. It's just kind of bizarre. They said, "Oh, that's the book that says there was another Watergate incident that you knew all about and nobody's ever been told about." I said, "What?" And I said, "I've never heard about that." So I don't know what, there's a lot of confusion out there about what your book's about.
Well,
I just made it more titillating.
Well, it was, I don't know what they're talking about as far as another Watergate incident. Well, it could be that, I don't know who saw the proposal. The proposal was 80 pages long. And
you sent me something of some girth that was early.
Yeah, and I sent that to you. That was, that was when in the end of 87.
Right.
When we were looking at, in fact, I was talking to you at the time about the Walters Memcons.
Right.
And you referred me back to your testimony. And if you can imagine this, can you imagine John Mitchell reading Blind Ambition? I convinced him to read it.
Did he really?
Yes, he did.
And what did he say?
Well, that's part of the interviews. He also read your testimony. I also interviewed Ulasewicz and Caulfield and a whole raft as a result of your telling me, read my testimony, and you know, see where we are on this. And as a result, we decided, based on their interviews, and based on what you wrote and what you testified to do some chapters on it, which were not in the original plan. So I wanted to get back to you and set up a time where we can talk at some length about what those chapters say. You may be referring to the Ulasewicz stuff, where Ulasewicz indicated that he was in the DNC 6 weeks before the break-in. Now, I don't know if that's what they're talking about. But there's a whole raft of material.
You know, I got to be honest. I mean, it's so hard for me to put my head back in all that. I mean, it really is, and I've really given. I really have given.
No, I understand. You know, I just want to be fair, because a lot of it, certainly the stuff that Mitchell has to say after reading your book and reading your testimony, and certainly the other materials that we developed, I think it would be unfair, at least, not to give you the opportunity to say this is true or this isn't true, as we did with them.
Right.
I mean, we never held back.
I'd be surprised, you know, if any of those people would still take on my testimony, but, you know, these are battles I'm not sure I want to fight anymore. I mean, you know, my testimony is my testimony. It was my best recollection at the time. I mean, I know I didn't intend to lie, distort, or anything like that, and if they remember it differently, fine.
I don't think that's the way it came out, to be honest with you. That wasn't the way I read it. There were various differences between what you wrote in your book and what you testified to. And I think that was where the problem came in. And that really doesn't mean that they're saying...
I've got to be very honest with you. I didn't even reread my testimony when I wrote my book.
Well...
I just wasn't trying to track this kind of literal record of history. I mean, I'm just telling you, these are my best recollections is the time I wrote both those documents.
Well, you know, it's a judgment that I leave to you. I'd be more than happy to read you. Certainly the stuff that Lydia has said, the stuff that Ulasewicz has said, Caulfield has said, because what they really, the picture they paint is that when you became counsel to the president, you inherited a Nixon secret operation. That's virtually the words that Ehrlichman uses, because the president had hired Ulasewicz, apparently, to do secret jobs for him. And I assume you were aware of that.
I was not.
That this is what happened. In 1969, the president called Ehrlichman and said, I need a private investigator. I need somebody that's going to go out there and do jobs for me, and I will pay him out of my personal fund. Combac will pay him the money on a monthly retainer basis plus expenses. And that's how Ulasewicz got hired. And the fact of the matter is that he did a number of jobs, beginning with Chappaquiddick. I think you would recall that.
I learned about most of this stuff after the fact. Really did.
You mean after?
You know, it's one of these things that no one ever, I was never in the loop on any of that. And Caulfield, you know, was assigned to my staff, much to my mystery as to what the hell he was going to do and why he was there. I mean, I scratched my head for a long time before I, and then it just kind of came out in dribs and drabs as to what he was doing.
Well, what he says now, and what Ulasewicz says now, is that you inherited him. And
I'd never met Ulasewicz.
No, well, this is, I'm just telling you what they said, and I think it's important because it goes back to a memo you got in January of 71, which you wrote about in your book, to look into the Hughes O'Brien matter. You got it from Haldeman, I'm sorry. And immediately there's a job that's assigned to Tony Ulasewicz to look into Hughes O'Brien. It's that kind of material that I'd like to share the material with you, because they're making a serious, I mean, they're saying essentially what you had going there was your own intelligence operation. Well, it may be crazy.
I mean, they're welcome to do it today. It just means nothing. I mean, if they get a lot of satisfaction out of just dumping this shit.
Sure, John.
When it's just an effort to go back and drift.
Well, they've hit, I mean, they've handed us, I'm...
It's not going to change my life one second what these people say.
No, but I want to be able to print the truth. And it puts us in a hell of a position if the only thing we're left with is...
I don't have to spend hours upon hours upon hours going through all this, refreshing my recollection. When you sent me those memcons, Christ, I just scanned them. I didn't want to read that stuff. I really don't. I mean, you know, I don't even want to try to remember what the hell I knew was going on then. I mean, that's history for me. I lived through it. You know, it was a terribly unpleasant but maturing experience. And what Jack Caulfield or Gordon Liddy or any of those guys have to say means not a tinker's damn to me, because I don't think they're very credible, honorable people. And they're just not going to affect my life at all. And it's very clear that, you know, if they can dump on me, they'll love to. And if they can rewrite history, they'd love
why
to.
Why would... See, that's the problem. I don't understand why you Lazowitz would single you out, because it doesn't make any sense in light
God
of the...
God knows what Caulfield told him.
No, I'm talking about what he knew directly. I'm only telling you what he told me directly. And the only thing that Caulfield...
Let me tell you this. All those guys are pissed off that I stood up and blew the whistle.
Yeah, the argument that...
I fucked up all their lives.
Well, it's interesting...
Think about their motives.
Well, let me give you an example. Okay, in your testimony to the committee, which I reviewed, let's just take two issues. One issue was the Larry O'Brien, to which you passed over as being a peripheral issue to your office. Literally, you just said, you know, we didn't have much to do with Larry O'Brien. But in your book, you say exactly the opposite.
Let me say, I can go through that process for you. What happened is the editors got real excited, interesting, wanted to make it more intriguing. That's why all that shit got in there. My testimony is what I'm going to stand on. You're asking me to go through a lot of labor to, you know, sort. I never actually went back and reread my testimony when I was writing my book.
All right, let me take one that doesn't involve that, which is Mitchell, because since he's no longer here, and obviously if he said what he said, and we report it, in your testimony, you said that Mitchell had come up with the idea to use the CIA to block the FBI investigation. That's a clear statement in your testimony that Marty and he met with you, and they knew a lot more about the CIA, and they decided that the idea was to tell Nixon to do that. Now, Mitchell denies that meeting ever took place. Just says absolutely flat out, that never happened. And based on the...
Why would I invent that?
Well, here's the point, and this is what Mitchell says in the book, and this is the kind of stuff I'd like you to deal with, because I think it's substantive. When you gave your testimony in June, late June of 1973, the taping system hadn't been revealed. When the smoking gun tape comes out, you say you met with Mitchell the afternoon of the 23rd, the morning of the 24th. Well, in fact, you did meet with Mitchell the morning of the 24th. I've been able to substantiate that without a problem, John. The problem is that on the tape, you say, or Haldeman says you said to him, I met with Mitchell yesterday, which would have been the 22nd, after you met with Pat Gray to be briefed on the whole thing that evening. Mitchell's covered for that period of time. So how could Mitchell says to me, how the hell could we have met when we're talking 7:30 at night? And he explains that way, and of course the tape indicates that your memory's incorrect, that it couldn't have been the 23rd or 24th if in fact...
It could well be if my memory's wrong. I don't know.
No, but it's...
I don't want to go back and try to figure this out. It doesn't affect my life a second.
All right, but in your book, something that's as important as that, something that's as important as something that's going to end the presidency of Richard Nixon, you don't even tell anybody about it. It's not in the book at all. And
I'm sure there are a lot of things that aren't in the book. I wasn't going. You've got to remember, I'm just coming cold off of what I remember, and I'm doing what I testified to what I remembered, and I wrote the book the way I remembered it. I'm not trying to take them on. I'm not trying to say they're right, they're wrong. I'm saying this is my view of what happened and why it happened. I'm trying to put together the pieces best I can.
But do you understand why it made a difference to Mitchell if it were the evening of the 22nd and not the afternoon of the
23rd? Let me tell you something, Len. You got your head down in there and all that, and you're trying to figure out who the hell's doing what and what happened. I don't even want to take my head back there.
Uh-huh.
I don't even want to try to remember the 22nd. You got to remember, this is a real fucking unpleasant part of my life.
I understand. But I think you understand, if I'm going to write a story...
Well, I'll tell you what we ought to do. What you ought to do is take the key points, the key issues, frame them as a question, or say, Mitchell says this, or Ulasewicz says that, you said this, what do you say now? And I'll go through, if you've got those all marshaled out...
Well, what I'd rather do than inundate you.
I can't sit here now, 15 years later?
Yeah, but here's the picture, John, that's being drawn. The picture's being drawn that the guy that had the motive to break into the Watergate, in fact, was John Dean. Because, now, hold on. Well, I understand where you're coming from.
Now,
but
do you believe that?
I'm only looking at the evidence that's been supplied to me, and I don't have anything to counter it. I would be remiss if I didn't come to you and say, look, this is what these guys have said, and they've supplied us with corroborating evidence. Well, hold on a second. I just painted you a broad picture, but right. when I use the example, because you don't know what it took for me to get Mitchell to read your book. I said, I want you to read what John Dean has to say. I'm not interested in that you don't like John Dean or you're mad at John Dean. Do you understand what I'm saying? Understand what the guy is saying. Read his testimony. Will the testimony stand up to corroborating evidence? And when you have something as important as that charge that Mitchell, in fact, suggested that the CIA be used to block the FBI, that's a serious charge. And it either can stand up to it or it can't stand up to it. And the fact is, that's a difficult ball game to be in. I don't want to inundate you with a whole raft of stories. All I can say is, when Gordon Liddy says to me that you're his contact man in the White House prior to the break-in, that's a serious charge. I don't know how you handle that.
And Liddy says I directed him to go into the Watergate?
What Liddy said was that prior to... First of all, Liddy said that you were the guy that got him the job. I don't think anybody even questions that.
No, I don't question that.
You don't question that.
No, what happened is Bud Krogh recommended him, and I carried the water for Bud.
I know, and I've talked to Bud. But what Liddy says is you're the guy who said to him about this intelligence plan and promised him $500,000 as startup money.
I know he's always said that, and I just don't think he understood. He and I were on some different wavelength.
Well, all right. All right, but then you get to the day, let's get to the Monday after the break-in, where Liddy says you and he took a walk across the ellipse,
right.
which Caulfield says he knows happened because he saw you two walking across the ellipse, and you don't deny that.
I testified it happened.
Right. He says two things of major import happened. One, you ordered Hunt out of the country, and two, you agreed to pay the Watergate burglars upon his request. At a time when... According to Ehrlichman, he hadn't even talked to you yet. He was going to talk to you that around lunchtime.
I'll tell you one thing. First of all, I wasn't that big a deal at the White House. Gordon Liddy knew where I stood in the pecking order, I'm sure. I wouldn't have the guts or the presumption to take in either of those and make those decisions. And Liddy would know well enough, damn well enough, good, that I couldn't make those decisions.
Well, Liddy, this is Liddy's...
Now, it might be interesting to rewrite history later and dump it all on old John, because they don't like me. And that doesn't surprise me.
Well, I'm not sure that...
I think it's not on this kind of petty shit that, they're trying to...
Well, wait a minute, that's not...
So ludicrous. That I won't buy it. I'm not even going to try to defend it. I don't want to fight it. It's to me, it's ludicrous on its face. And I think you know well enough that it is. If you're writing their view of what they say happened, well, write it. Fine. I'm just going to tell you, it's not true. It doesn't work.
You're saying that Liddy's wrong.
I'm saying Liddy's dead wrong. Yes.
Why would Liddy go after you?
Liddy's been on my case ever since the whole thing happened. Ever since I broke rank and testified.
You're saying because you didn't do what he did.
That's right.
That whatever he says has got to be looked at in that framework.
Well, I think I think it's very clear that he thinks that I should have never testified. That he thinks that you know, and Gordon seems to have impressions about what were said and interpretations. You know, I had some conversations with people like Krog and Magruder, and both said, you know, Liddy would take the teeniest thread of a thought and turn it into a command. And it was just, you know, Liddy was building and doing his own thing, and he was very good at this, very clever at this, and what have you. So you know, a lot of this stuff was sui generis. It was created by Liddy. You got to put these the Liddys, the Ulasewicz's, the Caulfields in context.
Is Mitchell in that same group?
No, but I'll tell you, in all due respect, one of the things I realized about John Mitchell over the years is that he wasn't, you know, he wasn't sharp. Didn't remember a lot of details. He had very visceral reactions to things. You know, we'll do this or we'll do that. I had to use to prepare Mitchell to testify, to go up on the hill. And he wasn't very good. He wasn't a very good witness. He couldn't hold facts. He couldn't hold information. And he's now later, you know, thinking about all this, reacting, oh, shit, if Dean said it, if, you know, the assumption is wrong or what have you.
No, I'm just saying to you, when he read your book and when he read your testimony, when he looked at his role and as it was described by you, and
let me tell you something, Len. The process, I went through this kind of detail on fact by fact by fact, because a lot of this has come up through the prosecutor, through the grand jury process, through the Senate hearings where they went over it. And we looked at all this, and you know, we tried to compare it. That's why it's so unpleasant for me to go back and do this, because I spent a year plus of my life doing this, every day, day in, day out. And yes, and there were areas clearly where my, you know, the issue that you're raising now on the CIA and that meeting, I remember that coming up, not specifically, I can't tell you the time it came up, but it came up very clearly when they were trying the case. And we looked at that and what have you. And I just said, guys, this is the way I remember it, and you know, that's all I can tell you. But I can't get my head back there now, Len. I just can't. It's something I want to do.
Yeah, and I don't blame you. I can understand the pain that's involved, and you can understand that if we're going to write it with their versions and not your version, other than, and I'm willing
but
to go.
I think you've got
to
be real careful.
Well, we're going.
You've got a very credible, interesting thing going. You got to be real careful with the sources you're dealing with, where you're taking these guys as the gospel.
Well, let me tell you. Let's talk about Mitchell, because I was shocked to learn on the day he died, or the day after he died. I read a story in the Post which said he never gave an interview, and he went to his grave with these secrets. Well, that, you know, I was stunned, because I didn't know I was the only guy he was talking to. And
I remember when Dick Snyder, I think it was, I was talking about this, tried to get Mitchell to write a book. And they did.
They gave him money.
Yeah, they gave him money, and then they tried. What happened is, he couldn't remember. He couldn't remember.
Well, that's not...
He couldn't sort it all out. He had a monetary motive at that time to write it. And they had somebody who was trying to go through it, and
Nick Timmish.
Who it was,
mm-hmm.
Who was a very friendly, cooperative guy, and they couldn't get it together.
I didn't, you know, the thing that's interesting about this is when Mitchell agreed to help on our project, there was no discussion of you, no discussion of his role. It was strictly the book that it's always been, the looking at where this information came from, how Woodward got it, the motivation behind it. And so he had no idea that we were going to walk in, and I wouldn't have walked in with your testimony in your book if I said, wait a minute, I want to understand, did you tell John Dean to use the CIA? And if you did, when did you tell him, and is his testimony correct? And he said, look at the tape recording. And the tape recording is clearly made the morning at 8:15 in the morning is when Haldeman talks to you, and Haldeman has attested to that. So now Mitchell's saying, see, there's no way that I could have met with him. And he hasn't, for every hour between the time you could have met with him and the time you talked to him, he's covered. And it doesn't make sense, because the tape, it doesn't lie. That's the one thing that doesn't lie. And that's a pretty serious error, if you're going to ring Mitchell into that. And I'm not saying that in the sense that I'm accusatory. I'm saying Mitchell's made his case and corroborated the fact that it couldn't have been him between 7:30 that night and 8:15 the next morning.
I don't rely on what I'm saying right now because I have not.
No, take my. I did not call you to have you talk on. Believe me, this is. If we weren't about to do what I think is a serious chapter on you, I wouldn't be calling you and saying, John, I want to talk to you in depth. And you're saying I don't want to go through that. And I'm even willing to narrow it to a few things so we can at least have a ballpark. I don't want to be in a position of saying something that's untrue. And I'm just not going to do it. If I have to say that John Dean doesn't want to go back, fine. I'm willing to stand by your testimony in your book versus their words. I don't have a problem with that. If you don't have a problem with that,
well, you know, I'm sure that you know, all these years later, people can pick at it.
I don't see that as. I don't see that the kind of things they're saying is picking at it. But what I am saying is, you've told your version twice, three times in court, in Blind Ambition, and in before the Watergate Committee. And I took when you said to me, Len, look at my testimony. I stand by. I did, John. I didn't come back to you and said, God, I didn't.
I'm telling you, I know what was in my heart at the time I testified. And I was determined, Len, to tell it the way I knew it, the best I could remember it, and what have you. If my memory was fucked up, if I missed something, if I was off, it wasn't for any motive other than the fallacy of the human mind to be a recorder. And because I just, you know, I said, this is important, this is vital, this is vital.
Well, this is going to be the end of a president in the end.
No, I didn't know that at the time. I had no idea where it would go. But I knew that I had to lay it down cautiously, carefully, as best I could, and as best, because I had no documents to use to refresh my records. I couldn't get to my files. You know that whole, I've written somewhere about how I had, I went through old newspapers and tried to look at things and remember what happened every day.
None of us, and I think nobody more than Bob Getlin and I have lived, we feel like we're in a time warp of 1972 to 74, and we can't get out of it. I mean, but that's okay. Obviously, we're being paid well now. It's been paid
for. It's been agony for me to go back.
And I understand that. And believe me, I'm going to tell you the same thing I told others who told me the same thing. Herb Kalmbach is a man. I'm not talking about you now, but because he didn't have anything to say about you. But Herb Kalmbach said to me, this is too painful for me. This was, to me, the destruction of my life. And the only reason he talked to me is because Mitchell picked up the phone and said, I want you to talk to Len. Caulfield didn't want to talk to me. I mean, we had a whole bunch of people that just didn't want to go through this again. But the kind of what's being raised here, even in your own words, at least I don't want to put words in your mouth, but there seems to be a feeling on your part as counsel of the president, you wanted to be in the intelligence business. You say that.
One of the assignments that was very clearly given that office. It was an assignment I was uncomfortable with from day one. I didn't know that business. I looked at that goddamn Tom Houston report, and I said, you got to be shitting me.
Uh-huh.
This stuff I didn't know anything about and didn't pretend to know anything about. And it was way, and I went to Mitchell at one point. Did Mitchell ever tell you how I went over there about that thing? I said, General, I don't have any idea what this is all about, and I find it pretty spooky.
Mm-hmm. No, well, here's the point. I'm always saying this is what we quote you saying in your book. I'm not quoting from them now. I mean, we have in our chapter proposal on this, which I think you ought to see, and I ought to send you a copy of that chapter proposal. We have you saying specifically that you felt you should handle all intelligence.
There's no doubt that I was a. I found out what they wanted me to do. I was a young guy on the make. When they gave me the signal, whether I understood it or not.
John, I'm not arguing that point with you, and I don't even want to argue with you. I'm just going to read you what John Dean wrote of Haldeman's interest in campaign intelligence for 1972. You wrote, quote, I reflected on how I might take advantage of Haldeman's preoccupation. I was still building my law firm seeking new business, and I knew the campaign would be a stepping stone for those who distinguish themselves. But as I looked ahead, I saw the counsel's office performing rather menial campaign tasks, legal chores hardly important enough to be admitted to the inner circle. If the counsel's office could play the same role at the Republican convention we played on May Day, Special White House tie lines, half hourly reports. I knew we'd be in the thick
of difference
now. Let me finish the quote. We had a jump on other White House offices in demonstration intelligence. Why not expand our role to all intelligence? That would be of interest to the president and the campaign. Now that's John Dean.
I don't disagree with that. That's the way it was. But you've got to understand.
No, but that's you wanting to do it.
But understand this. The perception of what I had at that time as to what intelligence was, and what I tried to do when I wrote that book is to get back and get my head to where it was so I could flush it out. I could explain it with the innuendo and what have you. I mean, I'm still this day would not say I'm sophisticated in the world of intelligence. At all.
No, but here's the point. Every time we followed the path, every time we took a lead, all right, John Dean makes a proposal that summer of 71 to Bob Haldeman that he handle all intelligence for the White House. It'd be funneled through him. He make a report for eyes only for Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and the president. That's, again, according to Haldeman, he has the document saying that you initiated the idea. You're saying he initiated the idea. I'm willing to say what each one of you said, you understand? And I'm willing to stand by your quote. I'll let that quote stand. We used it in the proposal because it came from John Dean. It wasn't something we made up. I'm not making something up, am I?
No. But the other thing is you've got to get these things in the...
All right, but then when you have Ulasewicz coming in and saying, I was sent into the DNC by John Dean 6 weeks before the break-in. He says that. Caulfield backs him up. That's a corroborating witness.
I can absolutely flat-ass tell you that is true.
But what do I do with the two guys that say it was true?
All I can do is tell you it is absolutely not, unequivocally not true.
That he did not go into the DNC.
I have no idea if he went into the DNC.
Did you know that you were in any way controlling him?
No, I did. I wasn't. To this day.
Now let's get away from you. Now, did you know the deal that Ehrlichman had made, the one I described to you earlier? Did you know that was the?
No.
In other words, When you came into the counsel's office, as far as you were concerned, Tony and Caulfield were a team, not the president.
Tony and Caulfield were a team.
I'm reading from your book, too, at this point.
Exactly.
You didn't know who paid him.
No.
You didn't know Kalmbach paid him.
No, I didn't. I learned it later.
Yeah, but you didn't know it when you say later, after the break-in? Well, that's okay. I'm not going to. I don't mean to do that. That isn't what I called for. I really didn't. This is not fair for me to.
That's why I don't. That's why you're going to fairly give you the answer. I've got to go back and read all that shit. I can't tell you now. 15.
No, and I. No, but you understand what I'm saying. I don't think it's fair of me to have done what I just did. No, that was unfair, and I plead guilty on that one because I didn't call for that purpose, John. You've been straightforward with me, and I expect to be straightforward with you. You may not like what we write, and you may attack that part of it, and I that's your privilege. But I want to be sure that I didn't reach a conclusion without John Dean's input.
I won't say anything because I'll let I find as soon as you start getting in and fighting about this, it just focuses on the issues. And what have you. There have been two or three or four other books that have come along the line just that stuff. It was so fucking ridiculous that I couldn't believe it. Reporters call huffing and puffing. Well, is this true? Is that true? And I said, guys, I have no idea. And I just don't even get into it.
Well, again, this is, from our point of view, you really have spoken about as much on this subject as any guy in the world has spoken on this subject.
Why I'm a target. I am the target. All these guys can say whatever the hell they want to. What somebody said to me, was really...
Well, let me give you an example of how I question the other side. Ulasewicz comes up with this statement. I was sent into the DNC by Dean in mid-April of 1972.
All right.
Well, and that's... No, he went in the middle of the day, and he produced a report which he sent back to you. He said,
"All right,
I'm not arguing that point. I'm not arguing the truthfulness or not truthfulness of it. I have a problem with. He said I told the committee that, and I told the prosecutors that, and they didn't want to hear it. Okay, to which my response is fine. They didn't want to hear it. Dean was their witness, so what? Why didn't you tell Hundley? You follow me?
Right.
We're now 15 years later. We're writing a book. In the book, we're going to say this is what happened, and frankly, I wouldn't have said this is what happened if Caulfield hadn't corroborated. I've got every one of the jobs that
he...
To determine whether it was a target or not.
A target of what?
Obviously a target for intelligence. I'm not, I don't know the specific thing that he had. I have got 80 of his jobs, a number of those jobs happening while you were counsel to the president. The majority of them happening while you were counsel to the president. The fact of the matter is, I don't know who did what to who in the sense of each individual job. When I asked specifically about that one...
I wrote about it, and I knew about Ulasewicz in my book. I thought he was an interesting, strange little character, and I didn't even know the name Ulasewicz. All I knew was his character, Tony.
No, but you did send Liddy up there, according to Liddy. Liddy said you sent him up there to audit him in January of 72.
I think that's right, and that was because Caulfield wanted that or something.
Yeah, Caulfield has told me he said it was his idea and that you wanted Liddy to go along. Of course, the question is, why, there's a whole lot of questions about why you would want Liddy to go up when Liddy was working at the campaign committee.
Well, let me tell you, I got to come back and tell you something. You've got to get some others than me if I'm the person you think is behind all it. Liddy, Caulfield, I've watched them both take, just the teeniest thing. When I'm off doing 400 other things, or anybody else, a Mitchell or a Magruder, busy on other things, and them coming by and, hey, John, what do you think about this? Is that a good idea? And, kind of a grunt, well, whatever you think, Jack. And then going off and doing something, taking like a damn command. And nobody ever, I'm convinced to this day that Mitchell, when he approved whatever Magruder brought in there, was a grunt and a groan and a flip of a piece of paper.
You don't think he knew what he was...
I don't think he knew, no.
You see, that's one of the things I told Mitchell, because he had asked me about our conversations, yours and mine. And I said, I think that there's a fondness for you from John Dean. I said, I can't prove that. You've never said that. But I said, just reading between the lines. John Mitchell is one story, but these other stories are different stories. And you're saying, well, they're really not credible stories, but they become credible in the light of the fact that every job this guy carried out is backed up. I have the backup material on it. He says he was getting his orders out of there. Caulfield says, I'm the umbilical cord that passed the orders on, and that particular order came from John Dean. I'm not saying, I don't, at this point, can't say what the hell that,
I'm telling you, Len.
You're saying it, you're just what?
I don't have any knowledge ever sending Tony Ulasewicz in. Whether somebody came into my office, Caulfield ever came into my office and said, John, I think Tony should go into the office, and I'm in the middle of something else, don't even reflect on it and say, whatever you think, Jack, which I did a lot. Just go on and do it.
But weren't you there, in a sense, Mitchell says that you were the entree for them, to him.
Caulfield?
No, to Mitchell. That these guys on their own, Caulfield, there's a meeting you have on November.
I know what you're talking about there. Caulfield.
I'm talking about November 24, 71, when you take
Caulfield,
both of them up there.
I just remember something. Caulfield wanted that Operation Sandwich.
Right.
Yeah. And Caulfield, he came in every goddamn day to ask me to set up a meeting with Mitchell.
And Mitchell killed it.
Exactly.
And then you brought him to be an aide de camp. On November 24th, you were in Mitchell's office twice that day. In fact, there were consecutive meetings, once with Caulfield and once with Liddy.
Don't deny that. I tried.
No, you testified.
You're pulling things out of my head.
No, I'm
always... It's not fair for me to try to go through this, because my head is not back there, and you're being unfair with me because I can't...
Well, I'm not going to...
It's totally different than the facts. I don't know.
I'm not going to be unfair. I'm not going to go through anymore with you. No, seriously, I'd like you to go through with me.
Tell
I know
me
it's
painful. Tell me how how we can do this procedurally. So
well, why don't we both think about it? I hope that we'll keep our lines of communications wide open and come up with a way that's set.
I find these calls incredibly unpleasant because you're making me go back, and I'm busy with other things. My head's elsewhere, and you know I don't like the prospect that somebody's trying to still spew the smear on me on this thing.
Well, in this case, one of the guys that's vehement on this issue is John Mitchell, and whether you think he was all there or wasn't all there, that's a judgment that people have to make. The fact of the matter is that there's an awful lot of material now on the record that we've gathered from him and from Haldeman, which indicates that there was more to the role of the counsel's office than just being counsel to the president, that there appeared to be at least the semblance of an intelligence operation going on. I want to be fair about that.
I don't know what the word semblance means, but it wasn't very sophisticated. It wasn't very... it just wasn't my bag. Something I didn't know how to do.
Well, I understand. And like I said, I don't want to go into any more of what you said or didn't say. I'm willing to pick some issues, send them to you, let you look at the stuff. I know it's painful, John, and I'm not in any way saying to you, hey, look, fellow, this is a great idea. I'm stuck with what I consider corroborated evidence. And based on that, we're prepared to write a chapter that essentially says that you had a much larger role in the early stages than has ever been acknowledged. And I want to be able to... I'm not Bob Woodward, and I'm not going to talk to people in garages, and I'm not going to play games.
Whatever happened to the Woodward side of the book? This is getting to sound more and more like it's a rehash of Watergate.
Not really. There's one chapter on this, and there may be a second chapter on this, but that's the limit. When we made the deal with the agent, which was Nat Sobel, up in New York, he felt this was not a book about Bob Woodward, and he was right. This is really a book about Al Haig and about the military and about the forces that were there to get Richard Nixon. And that's what the book's about. That's why we changed the title. If you notice, we changed it to A Silent Coup, The Removal of Richard Nixon. That's hardly John Dean, A Removal of Richard Nixon. So you're hardly our star player. But Al Haig is. Admiral Moore is. The book starts out that way. And what we essentially say is that Nixon's enemies fed off Watergate. I don't even think you figured out where all these leaks were coming from to Woodward. But Woodward clearly is the cat's paw, and that's the role he plays in our book. He's not the guy calling the shots. He's the guy fulfilling what his friends, his former friends, or maybe still his friends at the time, wanted. And I think...
I've always been of the opinion that the whole Watergate break-in was just an accident. It was Liddy doing his thing with thinking this is what Magruder wants, Magruder thinking this is what the White House wants. And just a travesty.
Well, you obviously, like I said, you were in the Philippines when this happened. By the time you got back Monday, Jeb was on the phone to you. That's your version from your book. Nothing I got from Jeb Magruder, but frankly, that's what you wrote.
That's right.
I don't know why the hell he's calling you. I have the foggiest idea why he's calling you.
I was over that meeting with Mitchell's office.
Well, I don't, Ed Gurney says to Magruder at one point, I understand what you're doing there, I understand what Liddy's doing there, I even understand what Mitchell's doing there. What the hell is Dean doing there? At that meeting.
I never understood that either. I want to tell you.
And what was Magruder's answer? Magruder's answer is, under oath, he was there because he was part of it. That's Magruder's answer under oath.
Okay.
And I'm saying part of what? Mitchell's sitting there, he's saying to me, Len, I sat there, we're not talking about charts now, we're talking about the meeting, the first meeting with Liddy, where both of you agree intelligence was never mentioned. But you agree to that, Mitchell agrees to that, Liddy agrees to that.
To this day, I can't tell you why I was, Magruder called me. I think Magruder had some perception that I was... Everybody seems to, you're saying, thinks that John was in the middle of intelligence, and John is the last to learn this.
Well, but the problem is every time you go to corroborate it, you're able to corroborate by a second person. And your answer to that is that the second person has an axe to grind just like the first person had an axe to grind, even though they may have never talked to each other in 15 years. And that's the kind of problem. Some of it deals with the evidence you submitted. you submitted a McCluskey report on McCluskey campaign headquarters. I think you might remember it as an exhibit that they had infiltrated it in one form or another. Do you recall that you submitted that as evidence?
No, I couldn't do this thing.
Well, that's one of the things I'd like to send you. But in any event, there are corroboration for their
side. Don't send me a bunch of stuff. Just send, figure.
Well, wait. First, you decide what you want. I'm not going to force feed John Dean. John Dean's a big boy. He doesn't need me to. You know, I've been appreciative of the fact that you've taken time, that when this book, long before it was sold, and you've said kind things about this book, and I appreciate that. But I'm not going to write a thing that I haven't at least made the offer as firmly as I know how to give you every opportunity to deal with anything we write.
If you could tell me where there seems to be some real substantive points of difference.
Well, obviously, when I got two people saying you sent the guy in, that's substantive. Now, you've denied that, and I'm going to say John Dean denies that happened. What else can I do?
I just have no recollection of it. I'm just telling you.
Yeah, the fact of the matter is that there's a pattern of you and intelligence beginning with that, with the O'Brien idea. In fact, you even say at one point, you said to Haldeman in right after ITT, which was what, the spring of 72?
What's interesting, because it means nothing, Dave. I could tell you, I'm being defensive about something I don't really give a shit about. I wish I could tell you, yes, I was trying to put together the biggest goddamn intelligence machine in the world, because I think that's what Richard Nixon wanted. He used to call me every night on the telephone and say, John, how's our intelligence apparatus doing?
I doubt that he did, and I doubt...
Or that, you know, that I just, you know, that I was cooking this up, I was going to build my empire, and by God, I was going to...
No, but you were interested in O'Brien, and you say it in your book, and one of the things that interested me is that one of the first people you talked to, rather than, and I don't even want to...
I will do that for specific instances, and I will reflect on them for you and tell you. And God knows I'm going to tell you if I'm dead wrong, and they're right, and I'm going to tell you if they're wrong.
Yeah,
I... And that's all I'll do. I mean, I've played it that way all the way along. What I can't do is just flip around to different things and try to get my head there. It doesn't go there anymore.
You can understand. If I'm writing a book, and it's only normal that someone sit down and read your book. I mean, what apparently we did that other people didn't do is we compared everything you said vis-a-vis each subject matter.
I didn't even do that.
I know you didn't, and I think you're going to be amazed at what you said in one form and what you said in your book. It's going to blow your mind. I had people say to me, Mitchell said to me, how could Dean be that stupid to write to tell the committee this, and in fact. He was deeply involved in the O'Brien thing, and
hold on just a second.
Sure, John.
So,
well, you look. You go. Look. You, do you
I
want me?
Somebody holding on the line.
You want?
Put
look. Why don't you
think? We'll talk about it later.
All right. Let me put some stuff together. I'll call you and then I'll send
When's
you.
When's your book coming out?
It's due out in the fall of '90.
Okay.
Anyway, we have time, and I'm not. I wanted to start early, so I will call you when I get some stuff together, and then I'll send it to you.
Okay.
Thank you, John, for returning the call.
Happy
Same to you and your wife.